What's up, guys? My name is Justin.
And this is Zach.
And you are listening to an episode of The Other Film Guys as we continue our favorite films from the year 2021. Last week, we talked about Zach's favorite movie of the year being 9 Days.
Go check it out.
And this week, we are talking about the epic movie Drive My Car, directed by Ryusuke Hamaguchi. And this movie is, without a doubt, in my humble opinion, easily the best movie I've seen all year. Out of the 40-something odd movies I've seen this year, this one, you know, far and above, was just the best movie I had seen.
It puts many, many entries from this year to shame.
Yeah, quite honestly. Before, I told myself that before making my top 10 list, that this was one of the movies that I had to see before making a legit list that I felt confident in. And I'm very glad that I had waited to watch that this movie, because it, you know, skyrocketed to number one. I think before this, I had Petit Maman at number one.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, this movie was even better than Petit Maman.
Oh, yeah.
And they're kind of similar in terms of their themes and what have you. But I just strongly, strongly connected to Drive My Car. And it was great. There's a few different ways that I guess I can like start by talking about the movie. I know we have to be a little delicate when talking about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, before we do, this movie is not yet available legally. So like I said on Twitter, if you want to catch this movie, let me know. And we'll
see what we can do.
We'll fix that. And we'll go from there.
So I feel like it might be maybe like a bit of a shorter episode or whatever, since we can't get like into details really all that much.
I think maybe like we just start off, you know, go through it as little as we can. And then at the end, you know, just give like a, hey, watch the movie before continuing further.
Well,
maybe one of those deals.
Well, let me ask you. I know you also enjoyed the movie a lot.
Oh, my God.
You know?
Yeah. Like I said last week, it's my number two.
Number two. Okay. What is something that, very first thing comes to your mind, what's something that stands out to you in this movie?
Hidetoshi Nishijima.
Agreed.
He is incredible in this movie. I've only ever seen him in one other thing. He was in Kiyoshi Kurosawa, 2016 movie, I think, Creepy. It's this like sort of like detective crime drama that he did. Movie's okay. It's pretty good. But, I mean, he's incredible in that. And he's incredible in this as well. I saw him and I recognized him immediately, and it was like, oh shit, I didn't even know he was in this movie.
That's great. I've never seen any of these people before.
He's the only one I've seen.
I've never seen a Hamaguchi movie before.
Me neither.
So this was my first time doing that as well. But you're right about Hidetoshi, because he's spectacular. I especially love watching actors act, if you know what I mean.
Because
I feel like, you know, the craft of acting is a very, like, fascinating process to me, just because everybody has a unique way of getting into their space or whatever and hitting the level they need to. And it's always interesting to me whenever, you know, actors put so much of themselves into a role where they kind of starts to have some kind of, like, toll on them, which you see sometimes. Hidetoshi, he has to, you know, take a couple moments to pause during his performances. During his plays. And I also kind of found a similarity in Drive My Car with that sense of Hidetoshi connecting to the text from the play. It reminded me of 9 Days, where Winston Duke's character, he was hesitant to go back and relive the play that he had done, that monologue, because it brought out such strong emotions in him.
It made him feel human again.
And that to me was kind of the same thing that Hidetoshi's character was going through as well, to where he didn't even want to play the role of Uncle Vanya anymore. Yeah. I think because it brought something out of him that he just wasn't.
Well, what does he say to Takatsuki in the bar? He says, Chekhov terrifies me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because like there's a part of you that lives that in it
brings,
or something.
That it brings out. Yeah. And it totally made me think of 9 Days. And I just, just thought that was fascinating. It made me want to go to a theater and like watch a play. It's been many years since I've seen like an actual play. Have you ever seen seen one or?
Yeah, I've seen a few in college and then post-college, mainly musicals. But I think I like plays more than musicals. I don't know. I don't necessarily have a reason why, but I definitely have an affinity towards them.
I saw one in college, like my very first semester in college at Texas A&M. I went to the play by myself, and it was an interesting experience for sure. But I thought the concept of the play in this movie was very interesting as well, with the multilingual aspect,
which I guess like is just, you know, the way that Hidetoshi's character works.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily caring about the actors being able to understand the languages or the audience even being able to. But they do, you know, have like the different tiered subtitles like that are projected in the back. So I think there's Japanese, Korean, and English that you can see whenever actors are given their lines. And obviously the actors, they don't all understand each other, but they're playing off of the rhythm and
their body language, really. Yeah.
A lot of rehearsal is that you see, and like whenever they're done, you know, doing their lines knocking. So I guess it's a lot of like memorizing, not only yourself, but everyone else.
And I, you know, speaking to that, adding on to that, it makes me think of, her name is Pakirum. Her character's name is Yuna Lee. She's a mute character in the film, doing Korean sign language, which was nice to see on screen. But she gets cast in her role mainly because she understands, and she says this herself, that the play is more than about like just the words that they're saying. And I think that like really like captures it right there. It doesn't matter. It doesn't necessarily matter that they understand each other or, you know, the words they're saying, but they still understand something that is like deeper than that. And is below all the words, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, he also says, you know, I mean, the script in this, I think, is probably the best script of the year. The answer is in the text.
Yeah,
read the text, and you'll be fine.
Yield yourself to the text, I think, is what
something like that.
What he says.
Yeah, I mean, he just emphasizes the text a lot, and I mean, you can see that in this movie as well. You know, it's all in the text, because one of the things you'll notice outright when you start watching a Hamaguchi movie, and I've seen two of them now, so I mean, I'm not, you know, the most well-versed, but I think I've gotten a sense of it, and I was reading this in a review, catching myself up, is these characters are all just, like, so restrained and mundane, and just, like, people that you would genuinely interact with. Like, nothing in this feels like a character, except for Takatsuki sometimes.
But even his character is kind of called out for not being able to hold himself back.
Yeah.
Which is what makes him a good candidate for the role of Uncle Vanya, at least in the eyes of Kafuku, Hidetoshi's character. So him being a character is kind of what it kind of plays to his strength.
Yeah, definitely. I know we're not doing reviews yet, but I did want to read this one just because it gives so much insight into the film and Hamaguchi as a filmmaker. For many films, emotion is the essence of and that which is coaxed from a character. They get to be dramatic, expressive, impassioned, perhaps displaying their scene-chewing abilities from time to time. For Hamaguchi, it's the opposite. His characters are so restrained, so mundane, so subdued in their expressions that for a long time it just feels like you're watching a well-filmed documentary. People talk at a dinner table like the way your quiet family would with unexpected guests, the way your professor would calmly explain a student's mistakes, the way you'd make tentative and unobjectionable small talk while riding in a stranger's car. It continues to go on, but I thought that was just so insightful.
Yeah.
That's from Letterboxd user Rebu, the O'Kalin on Twitter. It's one of the, you know, one of the most popular reviews, aside from Karsten's one sentence.
That, without fail, always gets thousands of likes and interactions.
We won't get into that.
We won't. No, I don't want to spend this time shit talking him, even though, never mind. But yeah.
Him as a person, whatever, but I don't know. I don't think his reviews should get the popularity that they do.
They're pretty much like tweets, in a way, like Letterboxd reviews. The most popular ones, anyway. You know what I'm saying? Give me something quick and snappy in a sentence.
If that's what you want to do, that's fine. But I don't think they should be in the popular reviews section. I think that the popular reviews, the ones that get you know, shown up to people who are looking into the movie, I think maybe should just be curated. and or at least reviewed, so that, you know, the shit that's just like, there's a 5-minute scene with a dog and it's the number one review for a movie.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, that's good to know, but come on. I mean, like, that in that incredibly insightful review that, like, it gives so much depth into the the movie is like number 3 or 4.
It kind of gets buried under there. Yeah.
And you know, it's not even just that, you know, like for people who don't have that big of a following, you know, like they're writing these, you know, these essays on these movies and probably are getting only like 6 or 7 likes.
Mm-hmm.
And then a comment about a dog gets almost 1,000. So I don't know. I guess that's just social media.
I was going to say, yeah, that just feels like the internet right there.
Yeah.
But the review was an accurate one. The one that you read.
Yeah.
About it being very restrained. Because, I mean, there are emotional things happening
incredibly in
the movie. Yeah. Like, I mean, I guess we can't get too heavy into exactly what happens. But, I mean.
Let me find a good plot description, maybe.
Yeah. I think that'd be probably best.
All right. So, from Letterboxd, Yusuke Kafuku, a stage actor and director, still unable after 2 years to cope with the loss of his beloved wife, accepts to direct Uncle Vanya at a theater festival in Hiroshima. There, he meets Misaki, an introverted young woman appointed to drive his car. In between rides, secrets from the past and heartfelt confessions will be unveiled.
Okay, so I was uncertain about saying whether his wife died or not.
No, but, I don't. I mean, while it's kind of like a spoiler, I mean, it's incredibly crucial to the movie. And I think the movie doesn't necessarily start until after that. Mm-hmm. Like, it's all just this, like, precursor.
Yeah, definitely.
That, you know, probably a lesser director would have just covered in, like, a montage in 5 minutes.
Right, yeah. No, for sure. It's a 40-minute prologue to start the movie.
Yeah.
And that in those 40 minutes, you're establishing who Hidetoshi's character is and also the bond that he has with his wife, Oto. And just kind of, it just kind of shows where they are in their relationship. They're going through their own struggles with something else that happened earlier in their relationship. And just kind of like the abruptness with how it ends.
Yeah.
And how there were still, like, a lot of things left unsaid between them, but they won't get to be said now because, you know, she passes away. And so the first 40 minutes are just kind of building up regrets that he doesn't know he's going to have yet, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And so those first 40 minutes, they're probably, those first 40 minutes and the last 40 minutes of the movie are probably, like, I was a wreck watching both of those portions.
Yeah.
Especially towards the end, man. Like, I was a mess. I love the relationship between Kafuku and Misaki, who plays his driver in the movie. They're great to watch. They kind of serve a purpose for each other that they both lack outside of their lives outside of each other.
Yeah.
Him playing kind of like a fatherly role towards her, and, you know, her vice versa or whatever. And
I mean, that's definitely one of the aspects that I loved on a rewatch that I didn't catch the first time. We can't really talk about it.
Yeah. That's why I'm saying, like, this might be a little short, because
fuck it. Go watch the movie. Pause this, go watch the movie, take 3 hours out of your life and come back, because I can't not talk about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
this is your warning.
That's as much as we could give you guys.
So would you like to say what it is then?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
So Tokumura, who plays the driver, Misaki, she's 23.
Mm-hmm.
He told her that he had a daughter who died of pneumonia when she was 4.
Right.
And then later, he tells Takatsuki that she would be 23 now, and she's 23. And so, like, she's putting it together that...
I love that moment where you can see where she, like, realizes that.
Like, it cuts away to her, and it's like, oh, and I didn't catch that the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There were a couple things in this that I didn't catch the first time, so I'm glad I was able to rewatch it for this.
I think, like, just, like, making that connection for her kind of, I don't know, it, like, kind of, like, deepens their bond with each other. Like, she realizes, yeah, like, the role that she may have been, like, passively playing in his life. Maybe she wasn't, like, aware.
And the role that he's playing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just the things that they were doing for each other that they may not have been aware of you know, initially at first, until they, you know, of course, start to get closer and closer throughout the movie. I love the way that that whole sequence is shot with Takatsuki in the car for that last time.
Yeah.
I really love the like straight on like close ups that they have of each other where they're like looking in the camera almost
to the side of the car. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, in that perspective, I mean, we are Kafku or Takatsuki.
Yeah. Like they're talking to us, telling the story. And it's a moment where Takatsuki's telling or finishing the story that Oto started.
I want to see Oto's story. I want to see that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
It was good.
I was very, very intrigued. But yeah, I love the way that was shot. And really, honestly, I feel like, you know, the movie, of course, has beautiful cinematography, but I feel like probably the top aspect that stood out to me, if we're talking like purely in a sense of filmmaking, is probably the editing in the movie. Such a strong, strong sense of emotional continuity. Just really carrying the energy from previous scene into the next one and then changing it and then carrying that energy into the next one. Like I love whenever it's in the prologue of the movie and I guess this part's kind of a spoiler, so you should have seen the movie by now. You had your warning.
Like we said, we're gonna keep saying it. No, we're not gonna keep saying it. If you go further, it's your fault.
Yes. But the big thing going on between Hidetoshi's character, Kafku, and Oto is they're married, but, you know, Oto, you know, she has affairs behind his back.
Usually her the leading man in her screenwriting projects.
And it's also like heavily implied that she has a relationship with Takatsuki as well.
Not implied. I mean, that's the guy that we see.
Okay. He's just like, his back is like to the camera. So I'm always like, well, we don't really see his face. But it like kind of looks like him just based on his hair as well and just how it looked. So I say heavily implied. I do think it is Takatsuki though. So their big thing is like, she does this and he's aware of it, but he never says anything to her. He never has maybe the courage to do it. Maybe he just doesn't want things to be different.
What he says is, you know, to God's guess, what have you ever confronted her about this? And he said, I never wanted to lose her. So I didn't even want to get into a situation where I could.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a that's perfectly captured at the beginning of the movie when he goes to the airport for something to do with his career, I'm sure. I can't remember what
it was.
Exactly.
Some other theater festival.
Yeah.
Jury duty, actually, I think.
Yeah, to serve for the theater festival. Yeah.
Something along those lines.
Yeah, as a juror. Yeah. And he drives all the way to the airport and he gets the message that
flight gets canceled.
He literally like just gets out of his car and they're like, never mind. And I just love how like, again, restrained and calm he is upon like learning that. He's just like, okay. And then he gets back in his car. Yeah. And he goes home and he catches Oto in the middle of one of her affairs. And, you know, instead of making it a big thing or calling it out, me, the first time I'm watching it, like I'm kind of on edge because I'm like, okay, I'm thinking she's either going to see him and like, you know, make it a thing.
I mean, he full on like walked in the room.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, she's going to be like,
yeah. Yeah, literally full on gasp.
But no, he just leaves and acts like nothing ever happened.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, as soon as he walks out the door, it's like a smash cut to him in an elevator or something. And the noise that he's hearing, I guess it's the elevator or something, but it's like really loud and annoying. And to me, that sound design just kind of like captures his mood. And also like he tries to light a cigarette and his lighter's dead. So he can't even get the simple pleasure of a cigarette.
Was it the wind, I thought?
It could have been. I just know he wasn't able to light his cigarette, which kind of contributed to, you know, how annoyed he was. Yeah. And then the very next cut is him in his hotel room getting his cigarette and the noise is gone. It's quiet.
Yeah.
So to me, that was his way of just kind of like stewing over it, being pissed off about it for a while. And then what does he do? He calls her as soon as he can just to talk to her.
Then just continues on as normal.
Yeah.
But he doesn't even share that the flight was canceled or anything like
that. No, he doesn't.
He says that he just made it safely and I would have brought that shit up. I would have been like, yeah, the fight got canceled, so I headed home for a little bit. And,
oh, boy. Yeah, that...
I will say, I mean, we already said it. She dies. After the revelation of her cheating, when I was watching this with Scarlett, when he came home and she was dead, she practically cheered.
Scarlett? Oh, yeah. My God. that's tough. Yeah, like, the whole time I'm watching... Like I said, I'm just expecting for, like, this blow up to happen, like, when he catches her or whatever. And it doesn't. And, like, I'm not going to say I cheered whenever Otho's found dead. But you know, it was unfortunate to watch.
Yeah.
And then that's pretty much the end of the prologue right there, like, after she dies. Because I think pretty soon he has, you know, a little wake for her or whatever. Talks to Takatsuki for a little bit,
and then does a scene in a play, and then he starts driving to Hiroshima,
mm-hmm.
and the credits roll.
40 minutes into this 3-hour movie.
I always love that.
I tweeted the reaction image of, like, those guys sitting on the couch and they, like, start cheering, and I was like, when the credits start rolling 40 minutes in, because, like, for real though, I was like, yes, let's fucking go.
You know, funnily enough, that tweet is what made me decide to watch the movie. Like, yeah. I got a copy from Luke, friend of the show, and it was sitting in my drive for so long, and then I saw your reaction to that, and I was like, 40 minutes and then credits? That's got to be some shit.
it was perfect, honestly. Like, yeah. Even in the context of the story and its placement in it, it really flowed beautifully.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing does. I mean, it's 3 hours, but it doesn't feel like it.
It's so well-paced. Like, yeah. I said, it comes down to that emotional continuity that it just really, it's just on that ass the whole time. The editing
and just how much you actually care and get invested.
Yeah, 100%. And it, yeah, this movie was an experience, a very, like, moving spiritual experience, at least for me.
You know, and I'm exactly the same way. You know, I feel like a changed man.
It'd be like that. Yeah, I watched it. It was one of those movies where, like, I watched it the first time, and it doesn't end on a like, bad or remorseful note or anything. So. It ends, you know, kind of like on a brighter tone, like, you know, an optimistic tone, I guess you could say.
Which I guess I want, like, what do you think, like, the ending? I think he maybe, I don't know, because it's not stated, so, like, we have no idea. Like, did he die and, like, he left the car
to
Misaki, or did she get a replica of the car?
See, to me, I guess what I think of is, like, he gave her the car as maybe just, like, as a token.
As a parting gift, maybe?
Yeah, as a token of himself. And maybe just, like, as a sense of, like, appreciation. And, like, it was the location where they bonded the most and where they both did their healing. And so, to me, like, I feel like he's fine. It was just his way of showing
That makes sense.
How much he appreciated what they had. And maybe they still have a relationship. We don't know that. You know, the last thing we see is...
She gets in the car and there's a dog in the back, and she loves dogs. We know that from the dinner scene.
Which I love that part, because that's me, totally. Like, oh, everybody's talking about me and complimenting me. Let me just disappear and go play with this dog.
Yeah.
Totally. I totally felt that.
But then she even later tells him, your words moved me very much.
And she's another, like, her entire role is very, very restrained. Like,
yeah. She doesn't ever really show anything.
But at the same time, she shows a lot.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
But, I mean, eventually, like, Kafku does eventually, like, he breaks down and talks about how much, like, how he just wants to go back. And he wants to see his wife and talk to her one last time.
That shit was devastating,
that
bro.
That hit me really hard.
Devastating, straight up. And how she's just very, like, she's very receptive to him and you know, and she's willing to participate in his grief, but maybe not, like, I don't know. She participates in it and, like, understands it at the same time. Cause like I said, she doesn't give a lot in terms of emotions, but she strikes me as somebody who her expressions to me came across as someone who's, like, come out on the other side of something like Pretty Bad.
Which, I mean, she did.
She did, right. But maybe she hasn't come out like completely through. You know what I'm saying? Physically, no, I mean, she came through, but, you know, emotionally or mentally, like, she's still...
I mean, that's how both of them are. You know, they still haven't accepted the grief of the loss of, for, you know, for Kafka, his wife, and for Misaki, her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, kind of her father. She just never knew her father.
And, funny enough, too, like, the complicated relationships that they both had with those people as well. Because Misaki talks about, like, how she loved her mom, but also at the same time, she kind of hated her.
Her mom would beat her.
Yeah. And, like, you know, the best times were whenever her mother would regress to this personality of a four-year-old, because she said that she had split personality disorder.
Yeah.
And you know, despite having those, like, really, like, strange relationships with them, and maybe they weren't always good or not always perfect, but that doesn't mean that, like, you can't, like, grieve for them or... You know what I mean? Like, feel some type of way about losing them. So it was just amazing to watch them unlock those things inside of each other. Just spectacular performances from the incredible. Both of them. Yeah.
I mean, you know, every part of this is just filmmaking at its peak.
And I feel like, you know, I already know when I go to these negative reviews, the number one thing I'm probably going to see is that it's boring.
Boring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this movie's like the furthest thing from boring to me. Just because, you know, it's not making spectacle of its emotional beats or of, you know, what's going on. Like, we don't see a lot of what happens, like, whenever Kafka gets hit by the car, you know, that just kind of, like, comes out of nowhere.
That's
in the frame.
That's one thing that, like, actually, like, or not that, but I was thinking of a separate scene.
And when Takoski, whenever he... beats up on that guy and kills him. We don't see that at all. He just kind of like disappears from the frame, then comes back and he's like, "What's up, y'all?"
So, all right, let's go. What are we waiting for?
Yeah.
Let's get literally. The fuck out of here.
Yeah.
No, there's a moment that I saw the first time, but I didn't put two and two together. When there's a point where, you know, they're going to the rehearsals and next to them in the car is Takatsuki and
Sonya's the character she plays in the play.
Yeah.
Janice.
It is Janice Chan, played by Sonya Yuan.
Oh, that's her actual name. Okay.
Yeah, that's her actual name. So you were right.
Yeah.
We see them in the car and they're both like, she looks ashamed. He doesn't really care, I don't think.
Yeah.
And then moments later we see that they rear-ended some other car, and I didn't actually see that the accident happen in the first time I watched it. So when they came in together like late, I thought, oh, okay, they were just fucking.
Oh, okay, so you didn't. Oh, I see.
And then like even like then later that day, I think when he's like, my car's being repaired, I was like, why is your car being repaired? I just didn't catch that the first time.
Which their relationship is also kind of strange. The more I talk about this movie, the more I guess I realize how it's like not life, I guess, just isn't exactly all about like the words or whatever, because they don't speak the same language. Janice and Takatsuki.
She does speak English.
She does speak English and Mandarin as well. He only speaks Japanese, yet they still, you know, are brought together. They still are. What's the word? Magnetate. I don't think that's a word. Gravitate. Magnetize? They gravitate towards each other. Magnetate, this fucking guy. But they still gravitate towards each other, you know, and they still strike up a relationship, however intimate it may be, because there was something more beneath just language and talking.
Yeah, 100%.
And so... yeah, the more I talk about this movie, the more I realize words sometimes just don't do justice.
They don't. It's about more. It's about feelings. It's about
appreciating, I guess, what you have. Yeah. You know, because like, literally any day, shit could change.
Like anything can change anyway. Yeah, any day is anybody's last day. Treated as such.
That's pretty much what the movie.
You love them.
That's pretty much what this movie is a reminder of. Even like. towards the end of the movie, whenever Misaki and Kufuke, they embrace each other, and Kufuke is telling him, like, you know, telling her, I mean, that they spend so much time thinking about, you know, the dead and, you know, the past, that they can't keep living like that, and that they have to keep living for each other. And I just thought that was a good encapsulation of, you know, the last 2 hours and 45 minutes before that. And yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
This movie kind of, to me, it kind of stretches the limits of what we know, of what we think of when we hear the word epic, because I do consider the movie to be an epic.
Yeah.
It's a long saga that takes place over the course of, you know, a couple years.
When you initially said that, I was like, is it an epic? I was like, yeah, I mean, it is pretty epic in its terms of, you know, storytelling and not in terms of its scale, of course. It's pretty limited in that regards. And, you know, it's not like it's not Dune.
Right.
It's not, you know, the Seventh Samurai, but, you know, it's still hitting like your emotions and in this epic way and teaching you these things. And
it's epic in its scale of emotions, exactly. I would say.
Yeah, it's great way to put it. It
tackles a lot of themes and really just, you know, like I said, your relationships with your loved ones, people that you're intimate with. The movie it's got a lot of good looking people in it. It's beautiful, effortlessly people. Sexy. And like that strong connection that it makes between sex and storytelling.
The first thing we see is Oto getting up. And she's, dude, that silhouette.
First time I watched that, that's like movie immediately got its hooks in me. Especially like the way it, like, you know, opens up, like, you know, an eyeball, like we're just waking up from sleep or whatever, and it's still morning time, and it's still a little crimson outside because the sun hasn't completely risen yet, and casting shadows on Oto to where all you see is her silhouette. You know, she's probably still in her half days or whatever when she's telling her story, since she needs him to tell her later what all she said. And
I like that dynamic.
Yeah, I do too.
That they both need each other.
Exactly. Right. And, you know, again, like their relationship is not perfect, obviously, but they still, in a way, need each other. Like it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't matter that it's not perfect. They still need each other. You know what I mean?
It's not perfect on the outside, but to them, it is perfect.
Perfect enough. Yeah. Yeah.
It's good enough.
It may not be perfect. It may not be perfect. I was going to say, like, does perfect enough make sense? It may not be perfect to other people's opinions or like the way they think, you know, a traditional relationship should be.
It works.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It works for them. And that's all they need.
And he says, like, you know, I thought that we were a very, very compatible couple, and I 100% agree.
Yeah, no, they definitely were. And I love the aspect of him continuing to have conversations with her after she passes through the tapes. Yes, that to me, like having that like constant dialogue with his dead wife, and just kind of like it's like they're still like talking, and they're still talking about like things that he's feeling. And like there are moments where through the dialogue that she's reading, like she's able to, like, you know, call him out on the way that he feels, like, you know, you're also just as responsible for your own feelings. You know what I'm saying? It's not just your convictions. Maybe it's just you.
Yeah.
And so like they're still like she's still connecting with him and telling him things that he needs to hear, even though she's not there. And that's like all he has of her is this pre-recorded version of her. And
it's this moment stuck in time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And I mean that, like I said, just having that constant dialogue and also letting Misaka in on letting her in on that. I hope I said her name right.
Misaki, I think.
Misaki. I said Misaka. Misaki.
I think we've both messed up pronunciations a ton.
I do apologize.
We're bad at it. We learned that back in the Korean
very,
series.
I was gonna say series. Very first one. Yeah. and letting her in on that, if nothing else, just to hear, and like, you know, in that way, also she also discovers what it means to love somebody who is deeply flawed, just as she did with her mother, and to be loved back by that person who also loves somebody who is deeply flawed, because you are also deeply flawed.
Yeah.
And like I said, just that constant dialogue and their conversations with each other, the way he doesn't want to play Uncle Vanya in the play, but ultimately ends up doing it. Like, man,
it has like, I think, I don't know if they said or not, but like, you know, just this incredible performance where, you know, this standing ovation, this incredible praise. And
yeah, yeah, for sure. That I would watch that play.
Oh yeah,
I would absolutely watch that play. But yeah, I also like the score. I think it's got really nice music, especially at the end.
It didn't stick out to me too much, but I thought it was good.
I guess like the main track that stands out to me is the end. To me, I think it coincides pretty well with where we are in the movie, and the mindset of Misaki as well. It's like this like nice lo-fi chill vibe, and it's just, I don't know, it was nice to hear. It's something like you could fall asleep to,
yeah,
type of thing. And yeah, the movie's kind of like that. Like, it's gentle, but when it strikes, it's really like precise where it strikes you, and you're like, oh damn, okay.
When it hits you again, it's like, oh
yeah, I thought we were done with this. So it's a expert film, the best movie I've seen this year,
yeah,
period, no questions asked. This also feels like one of those movies where you can watch it at different stages in your life and it'll mean something to you.
Like kind of like Synecdoche. And,
yes. That's exactly what I thought of when I first watched it. I was like, it's going to have that unique,
which is another film about acting.
Yeah. Right. For real though. Yeah.
And life.
And yeah, I just immediately knew it was going to be one of those movies that had a unique viewing experience.
Yeah.
It's going to have a unique viewing experience every time. And I feel like that's got to be like the pinnacle of making cinema. You know what I'm saying? Like,
You got to have something to say, and you got to teach something. I think those are what makes some of the best movies.
Facts. And this absolutely does that. And I feel like it'll be timeless. And as soon as it becomes available physically, I have to buy this.
I'm buying that up. I think Janus Films picked it up for a distribution, so it might end up in Criterion.
Hell yes. This is totally a Criterion movie.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
I can,
if there's ever an argument for like a modern film to go directly into Criterion, it's this
one. This one right off the bat. I can already see the logo spinning on the screen before it starts playing. So as soon as it becomes available, I have to buy this because this movie just really spoke to me. You know, I watched it at a moment that, you know, kind of coincides with my personal life, and it just it was true and it was genuine and it was very moving. It was very moving. First time I watched it, you know, I was just kind of like, just kind of like sitting on my couch, just like processing, you know what I mean? It reminded me of when we watched the season finale to Succession.
Oh my God. Yeah. Which I can't believe we've gone so long without talking about.
I know, yeah. I was thinking about that the other day. Like, we didn't mention that at or nothing on the podcast.
I think the first two episodes back, I was like, okay, I have to remember to bring it up this time. But
that's exactly what it reminded me of, was just kind of how, like, I needed to sit with what I just watched. And with Succession, that one was more out of, like, surprise and, like, anger and frustration. But this one, it was really, like, it was extremely introspective movie and an introspective experience. And I think I said this last week, but it's very similar to 9 Days as well, a very introspective spiritual film. And so I can't stop gushing about this movie.
So let's get into our final opinions. I think I'm at the same place.
Let's do it then.
So I mean, I think it's obvious.
Yeah. What are we doing here?
We give this a collective 10 stars.
Quite honestly, yes. Yes.
I mean, no, yeah, collective 5+5. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we've been talking about it for the last, 40 minutes or so. So, I mean, I don't know.
That kind of flew.
kind of like just like the movie does.
Yes.
I mean, I won't lie. I was intimidated before watching this.
Okay. See, I was kind of feeling that same way about talking about it.
Yeah, I was too. And it's just, you know, we're like, the runtime and the acclaim that it has so far, you know, like worrying that, you know, you'd get disappointed or something like that. But
yeah, happens all the time. For me anyway, it happens a lot.
10 minutes into this, I was like, oh my God, I should not have waited.
Yeah, exactly.
Walk, don't, or no, run, don't walk.
Facts. Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah, I can't say any more than we already have. I love the performances. I love, you know, the great, but, you know, pretty subtle cinematography. I love the editing. I think it's some of the most effective that this year has had. I can only think of like two or three that I think are like incredible and just up there. And this does it.
Agreed.
All right. So we want to do a bad review. Oh, here we go. Yep. You were right.
Yes.
All right. RD half star says incredibly boring, long and dull. Completely void of any visual storytelling. Performances were one-dimensional and monotone. Almost no variety in shot choice. Dialogue was flat and uninteresting. Wish I could rate it zero. You know what's so funny about that too is that they have, I mean, this isn't a dig to the movie, but they have Paris, Texas as one of their top four movies, which I think is maybe another one that's kind of similar in scope and scale.
Yeah, no, agreed. Yeah, it's definitely in the same vein, I would say. Shot variety, I have conflicting feelings about that, because that makes me think of that fucking guy that tweeted about the Resurrections and how like they just have a lot of like, you know, reverse shots and close-ups of each other. But like, to me, like, okay, like cinematography is like not just about like variety, I guess. Like it is, but at the same time, there's like more that goes into it. Like it's about composition, it's about lighting.
Cinematography is having something that I can set as a wallpaper, Justin.
See, what he failed to notice was every scene that he was calling out, like they all looked different from each other.
Yeah.
So even though, yeah, okay, we're going through, because a lot of those are like one-on-one conversations between actors. So yeah, okay, we're, you know, kind of swiveling from one to the other. They all look different from each other, though.
And a lot of these are like one shots, mm-hmm. like one shot scenes, and it's like, how?
Yeah.
I mean, just shut the fuck up.
Yeah. 100. All right. Hush puppy. Half star review. Too long, dry, and frustrating. Like Citizen Kane in length and feeling, but without the ending. So dead. Super disappointed in this, but had a great mate first date, so will definitely be a memorable one in some ways. My favorite part, the cigarette still. A still? Imagine. I did like the cigarettes, though.
Yeah.
I do like seeing people smoke on screen.
It's fucking cool.
It is fucking cool. I would never do it myself.
No one does it like Wong Kar-wai, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no for one sure. Does it like I'm pretty him. Sure he invented smoking.
Oh, yeah. He went back in time and invented so you could have those shots.
Exactly. For the sake of cinema. Gotta love the dedication.
I found this one that I knew was inevitable. And, you know, I think it will be a very hot topic come award season with the Academy nominations and, you know, awards coming out in the next couple months. Cecilechin 75 says, I really don't like the way that Japanese movies tell a story. I thought this movie would change racist. My mind, but it did not. What the fuck? Like, that's not even critical. That's just straight up racist.
Yeah. Why
like, what the fuck?
This guy, fuck off. All right, let me see. Also, with a lot of these bad reviews, some of them, they don't be like giving like specifics on like what they don't like about it.
Because there's nothing that they actually don't like about it. They just want to be different, Justin.
I see. Let me see. Okay, here we go. A one-star review from Sunny. So glad I didn't see this. What? Oh, okay. So glad I didn't see this overhyped yawn fest and its cheap delivery at VIFF. Don't know what that is.
I don't know what these are.
People on here are sheep. God forbid you think differently than the most popular review from some random dude on Letterboxd, right? Again, it's okay to like things that other people like. That doesn't make you a sheep.
I don't know where this like concept comes that like, you know, we all collectively just check Letterboxd before forming opinion.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
Like I know that if I was completely isolated, I would have loved this movie all the same.
Yeah, no, for sure. I watched it by myself.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And both times I've seen it by myself, and it was, I don't know, I wasn't going to sleep. I was completely engaged.
All right, so let's get into a positive review. Yes, okay. So Patrick says, and this is a point that I wanted to bring up, but just simply wasn't able to. 4.5 star. I know there's way more important stuff here, but I have to point out that the two-door red Saab, which is a Saab 900 Turbo S, 1982, I want to say, is one of the best movie cars I've ever seen. Just a truly excellent car. Lots of character. I 100% agree.
Yeah.
I love the conversation around cars and films. I've talked about it so many times.
It is an ex... calling it a character unto itself is...
It is.
...accurate. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Especially, it stands out amongst, like, other cars as well. Like, especially at the very end, whenever Misaki is walking to the car, you know, she's walking past all these other cars, and they're all, like, generic, like, white, gray, maybe black, and then there's this red car. And then, like, you automatically know
that's her. Which, I mean, it's special in itself because, I mean, it's not a Japanese-made car, so it's actually a left-hand drive car, but they're, mm-hmm. they're a left-road driving country.
Okay, okay. I was like, I thought they drove on the right. It was kind of confusing to me for a second, but that is an accurate description of the car. Definitely a character of its own. I'm going to read Luke's review, his their five-star review, because they put me on it, and shout out to them. So. They called it a perfect slow burn that completely guts you without realizing it. Nothing short of perfect. It might feel aimless to some, but there is so much purpose in every scene and line. Not a single moment wasted in its almost 3-hour runtime. Just gives the perfect thing to destroy you before it gives you the will to live. Easily one of the essentials of the year. And
yeah.
gutting is an accurate word because you just... Those emotions, like when it's like a boil, you know, like once it starts like coming to the surface and it really just like comes out, like I just could not stop weeping for like a good like 10 minutes. It's excellent. Excellent.
That was a good review.
Indeed. Yes.
I love Luke.
They're Shout so out cool. Luke.
We need to have them back on the show.
We do, for sure.
We'll get something. All right. So we're going to talk about some movies that we've seen in between episodes.
Let me go first. I feel like you've seen way more than I have. Or
probably, I don't know.
I'm going to say, because I've only seen two.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. I've been working a lot this past week because I'm going back to school next week. So I'm just loading up on my hours.
Yeah.
So I didn't get a chance to watch anything, really. I watched these movies probably the day after we recorded the last episode. And then I hadn't seen anything since. So
other than drive my car,
yeah. So but the first movie I watched was Memoria.
Oh yeah.
With Tilda Swinton, and that was an experience. That low-key, to me it kind of came across as a horror movie. No, I won't explain.
Explain further. No.
Just the vibe that I got. And it was very, okay, well, like, especially, like, with the banging that would happen.
Yeah.
Bro, that would scare the shit out of me every time. Yeah. Yeah. And just how, like, you don't see where it's coming from and, like, how, like, startled she gets every time.
I love the scene where they're, like, trying to recreate it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. In the sound booth or whatever. Yeah.
That was so good.
That very, very slow-moving movie. Like, very, like... in quicksand, but like it knows that, and like it's trying to use that to its advantage and its narrative. Like that's a purposeful move that it's making to have these extremely long scenes with minimal cutting. And there's really, I noticed that there's like no close-ups in that movie at all. Everything is done in wide, or the closest they get is medium. But there's never a moment where we're close on anyone or anything, really, which I thought was really interesting. Like, every time we're with Tilda, we can see at least, like, her upper half of her body. And I just thought that was really interesting. To me, it put more of an emphasis on, like, the surroundings, and which I think the movie, you know, on a greater level was speaking more about, you know, surroundings and the earth and just nature in general and... memories, obviously, and it's far too abstract and grand for me to try to diagnose and dissect and explain after one sitting anyway. So I will leave it at that. But
it's a good ass movie, but I will say I still entirely disagree with Neon's strategy of
Very weird.
A permanent theatrical release, only one theater a day.
Yeah, very, I don't know the thinking behind that, but...
Because no one's ever going to see this movie legit.
Yeah.
That's the brutal fact of it.
Yeah, it played in Houston that one day during the Houston Cinema Arts Festival. Yeah. We didn't go, obviously, but yeah, it was a good movie. Definitely unique and interesting and trying something new and something true, which I can always appreciate in film.
Oh, yeah.
And then I rewatched Come On, Come On. I don't know if I mentioned that I watched it in the last
podcast. I don't think so, no.
Okay.
No, well, I just sent it over to you later.
That's right. Okay, yeah. So I watched it twice then in the time that you sent it to me. So I've seen three movies and they're... Not three movies, two movies, and I've seen one twice, being Come On, Come On, with directed by Mike Mills and featuring Joaquin Phoenix and Woody Norman.
Oh, my God, Woody Norman.
Woody Norman with the best performance of the year. So just 100%. Put that out there. Amazing that this was his acting debut, you had told me. Yeah.
Well,
I think it was his second thing, actually. Debut,
but I know that he was like just this random kid that they auditioned. They didn't seek him out. He was the second kid.
Okay, that's right. Second. Okay.
And he's British too. And he's just, I mean, I thought it ever since I saw it the first time. That's the performance of the year. I want to grow up to be just like Woody Norman.
He's like glove in hand in this movie and what it's going for. And I feel like
Gabby Hoffman's great too.
Oh, yes. I loved her. She was fantastic. I feel like Norman. His performance, like, just really, in general, just really captures just, like, the essence of an entire generation. And, I mean, the children are the future, and any hope is with them. And it sucks that, like, they know that, and, like, it's not like they asked for that, you know what I'm saying? And they didn't ask for this responsibility to save the world or whatever, but it's being thrusted on them anyway because adults are dumb and think they know everything. And I appreciated that too as well, like how seriously it took children and how they have valid viewpoints as well and their feelings are just as real as yours. And
I love that in media in general is not treating children like children, but treating them just like people because they are fucking people.
Exactly. And like they should be listened to. And you know, honestly, I feel like if
more... We learn a lot from them.
Yeah, absolutely. And if more people were listened to or had a way to express themselves as children, we'd probably be a better place in general. 100%. So the movie really, to me, just captured that notion very well. And I watched it twice, and I may have liked it just a tiny bit less the second time around, but I still think it was an excellent movie. Very warm and gentle, and Joaquin Phoenix is great. Channeling the same sort of vibe from his performance in Her, Spike Jonze, who also kind of has similar tonal movies to Mike Mills. They're warm and compassionate and sweet. And the movie was a great experience. And so that's all I've seen, just those two movies.
All right, well, I have seen some more, and one of them has a story. So we'll get into it. First movie I watched after recording our last episode was The Maltese Falcon.
Incredible. The Millennium movie. Falcon.
Oh boy. Yeah, that's Scarlett. Sometimes she just be goofy as hell. But I love that movie a lot. I saw that initially in college in a film and literature class, and I love it. Humphrey Bogart's great in it. The score goes fucking, it slams into you, dude.
Nice.
I love old movies for that. Then afterwards, and this is one with a story, although I have tweeted about it. So I drove 6.5 hours.
That's right. Okay.
Total there and back to go see There Will Be Blood theatrically.
On 35, right?
No, it was not on film, unfortunately, but it was at the very historic Texas Theater, which I didn't know why it was historic until I was there and friend of the show, Zach, had explained to me that it was the theater that apparently, Lee Harvey Oswald. What's his name? Who assassinated JFK?
Wasn't it Lee Harvey Oswald? I think it was Lee Harvey Oswald.
It is Lee Harvey Oswald. For some reason, I thought that was Lincoln's
allegedly.
Killer. And that's the theater that he apparently escaped to.
Okay.
And so like it's got like this like memorabilia, like not just from like the JFK stuff, but like incredible film memorabilia. There was this like, you know, those stands that you put your head through and you take a picture with.
Yes.
There was one of those for like the picture at the end of The Shining.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
So cool.
Nice.
They had like pizzas there.
This place sounds great.
It's like a, you know, it's one of those like, you know, like smaller theaters that you see in like movie theaters or that you see in movies all the time. Mm-hmm. Not these multiplexes, but like, they're like in the wall of like a shopping center or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So cool. I love shit like that. Like with actual marquees and stuff. And
I feel so starved for like stuff like that.
Yeah.
It sucks. I know we always talk. I know we talk about this every week, but I just cannot get over it.
I'll never forgive Houston for taking away Landmark River Oaks.
Ugh, tough, man. Tough scene.
It hurts. But yeah, drove all the way there. Did not realize that it was going to be fucking freezing. So I ended up wearing a suit jacket.
The suit jacket, a blazer.
It was literally the only thing that I had in my car.
I'm dead.
And because like next to the theater there was parking, but it all had park meters. I was like, I'm not gonna fucking pay for parking.
Yeah.
So I parked in this parking lot that he told me was nearby, and then he pulls up to it and was like, oh, you forgot to pay for the meter. He's like, oh, these aren't real. I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
They're not real?
No, they're just there. I guess they don't work anymore or something like that.
Oh, that feels very misleading.
I felt very misled after already like having to go through fucking Dallas roads, which I don't know if you've ever driven through Dallas, but it is the worst experience in my entire life.
Yeah.
Anytime I have to, oh God, I missed like two exits and it sucked. They're just not labeled and it made me want to cry.
Oh, were there a lot of people at the movie?
No, it was pretty tame. But you know, I think we'll be recording an episode on it pretty soon. I'll give my thoughts on it, how it was theatrically, but in a very short sense, I found it to be a lot funnier seeing with the crowd.
See, I thought the same thing, but with The Shining and it being scarier when you and I went to go watch it.
Oh my God, it was
a lot scarier in theater. I legit moments where I would like jump because I was
startled.
Which
makes me just yearn for the moment that I'm able to see 2001 in a theater.
Oh yeah, absolutely, for sure.
Yeah. Then rewatched Drive My Car and rewatched Uncut Gems. The Uncut Gems one was because now I finally have a 4K Blu-ray player with my PS5, so
fuck yeah.
Threw in the 4K Criterion and got that bad boy going. And let's see here.
Did you watch one of these this week?
I did. I'll get to that pretty soon here. Oh, actually, that's the next one. I saw Crisis or Crease, Ingmar Bergman's very first feature film, and it was really good. I ended up giving it 4 out of 5, which was more than I gave to Smiles of a Summer Night, which I ended up changing to 3.5. But Crisis was really good. It's very Bergman-y. Much more Bergman-y than I think Smiles of a Summer Night was. I don't know how to describe that, but it just is. And, you know, so that was number 2 of my 52 weeks of Bergman challenge. Next up will be A Ship to India.
Nice.
And pretty hyped for that.
This is a good little challenge to do. I'm excited to see if you do all of it. The purist would want to do it.
I fully plan on it. I've had a great time so far, and We'll see how that continues. Then, on a whim, I was able to see The Tragedy of Macbeth, which I liked it, but it was a little bit, I don't know, it just...
Underwhelming?
Yeah, not even necessarily like underwhelming. Like I think it was perfectly to the level that I thought it was going to be, but my main problem with it is that it is completely ineligible for anybody who does not already know Macbeth.
Okay.
That's how I feel. I mean, Scarlett and I think we understand things pretty well, pretty easily. And I've already seen many interpretations of Macbeth, so I know the story. And she did not. She's never seen Macbeth or anything like that. she was completely lost the entire time, because it is very faithful to Shakespeare's original text.
Yeah, I know, like, Denzel, like, I've seen tweets about him and, like, reciting, like, straight-up Shakespeare.
You
mean, like, in terms of, like, the language and, like, what they're saying?
Like, I mean, you can, like, see what's happening and, like, you can see the characters and everything, but, like, what they're saying and, like, you know, the meanings of everything,
it's...
Even for me, who's, like, already, like, seen Macbeth and knows it, I was kind of lost.
Okay.
Everything about the movie makes me want to love it. The cinematography is gorgeous. The production design is incredible.
It looks great.
The editing, I think, is where, like, it's shown for me as well. Mm. And some of the visual effects and the production design is just incredible, I think. It just did an outstanding job technically, and the performances are all great. But I think the biggest problem is the screenplay and how they chose to go, you know, very, very to the text, which, I mean, I tweeted about it and it's in my Letterboxd review. Three different groups walked out of this movie in three separate times.
Okay. I remember you writing about that. I was like, what could that mean?
There was one of the groups that was like, man, that's just too bad. And like, they were talking about the movie and like how I assume too bad that they didn't like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, I mean, everything about me wanted to love it so much. And I think it's a great movie.
An interesting choice, because I feel like that, like, makes it a very niche type of film way.
Yeah.
And I don't think, at least for me, because I didn't expect it to be like that.
And it's not even like, you know, I can hope for an ineligible movie as far as like as what you're able to hear, like kind of like Tenet was.
Yeah.
Like just like wait for subtitles and you'll be able to understand it a little more. No, you'll understand it just the same, I think.
Yeah. It's the meaning behind
it. It's saying. A little unfortunate because, you know, I would have loved for something like this to go like huge.
Mm-hmm.
And for masses to love it. I mean, I guess, you know, he's not making it for the masses, maybe.
I was going
to
say he had to have known Joel Cohen. He had to have known that he was going to alienate probably most people with it. So I'm sure it was a conscious decision.
I just don't think it was. I don't think it was the right one personally, but maybe that will change over time for me.
Not everyone's a Shakespeare expert.
No. Then I watched The Hand of God.
Okay. On Netflix.
On Netflix. That was a movie that, you know, like didn't disappoint me because I didn't know what I was going into. But it didn't impress me or anything. I didn't feel anything.
Didn't move you?
No. Like I ultimately at the end of it I was like, okay, well that was 2 hours.
That was another movie.
I mean, it wasn't bad. It wasn't great. I mean it was a fine movie, and I think the main actor, I forget his name, but he was really good. The cinematography was really beautiful. But that's really as much as I can give it. Filippo Scotti is his name. I don't know. It has some like cool things with like the family interacting that I liked, and I kind of wish they did more of, but I don't know, it just feels empty.
Didn't hit.
They won't always.
Nope.
And last movie on my list is I watched the YouTube documentary Raising Kratos.
Nice.
About like the making of God of War 4.
Okay, when you play games, like especially like those like big RPG games, do you like just play like the main campaign and then like you're done? You don't play no like side quests or nothing?
It depends. It depends on if the side quests are fun. Like for Spider-Man, I'm, you know, like pretty close to 100%ing it.
Oh, damn, for real?
Yeah. And for God of War, once I finish the story and they're like, well, we can go... Anytime you finish, like you unlock a new area... Atreus is like, well, we can either, you know, go do the mission or we can explore a little bit more. I just want to go to the fucking mission.
Yeah, I love the dialogue that they have throughout the entire game.
It's so... Sonny Soljic is Atreus from mid-90s, which we covered on the show back when Josh was subbing in for you. Really, really great voice work and, you know, like... And they did a lot of mocap for the game as well. Oh my god. And Christopher Judge, I think, is the voice for Kratos.
Yeah.
He was so incredible. Corey Barlog, the director for this game, he has such a great vision. And he was the director for God of War 2 as well, I found out.
That's amazing, because like if you compare like Kratos from like the first three God of Wars, like He's just like this like rampaging killing machine that's not really having these tender conversations. So him have that in the new one, it's like, wow, I didn't know you could go this way.
I think like if you've played the game God of War, you should watch that documentary. It was incredible. I finished the game this morning, and I might go back and do like some of the side quests for like the lore, because subsequently I've been really into Norse mythology because of this game as well.
Yeah, for sure.
And I don't know. Great fucking game.
Incredible game. I don't pay full price for games, but there are a handful.
It's only $20 right now, too.
Well, see, I'm referring to Ragnarok, the sequel that's going to come out. Yeah, like, I will pay the $70 to buy that game.
I'll probably have it pre-ordered.
I might do that, too, because it was that one. Horizon Forbidden West, it's another one where I'm like, yeah, I'm immediately dropping $70 to pay that. I love that game. This game's great. And I feel like there was another one, but those two for sure, I made the decision, like, I'm going to have a PS5, and I'm going to pay the full price to play them shits.
You know, yeah, the moment that I know that I wanted to get a PS5 was when they, weird enough, when they announced Spider-Man 2 and Wolverine.
Oh, I forgot they were doing a Wolverine thing.
Wolverine, I think, will probably come second, because, I mean, they didn't even have any, like, gameplay or anything, or not gameplay, but, like, much for that. They just have the reveal of the claws. But I think they're both supposed to come out in 2023.
There's a couple of other like superhero games.
I don't know what else is coming out in 2022.
There's Suicide Squad has a game coming out.
Suicide Squad, and then
there's Gotham Knights. I think Gotham something. It's with not Batman, but his
because it doesn't take place in the Arkham series. But Batman is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just Robin, Nightwing, Red Nightwing. Hood, and Batgirl.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So I'd be interested in playing that one.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna. I think that is Gotham Knights, maybe.
But yeah, those games I'm definitely excited to play.
Yeah, and then you know, God of War 2 and Horizon Dawn 2 are coming out this year. So those are.
That scared me.
That's my cat food dispenser.
That's cool.
Every 4 hours it feeds our cats, and we recorded a voice message that is, Soulja Boy, tell him, now come get your food.
Look who it is,
bitches.
Come get your food.
Non-derogatory, Shiv. Of course. And Shiv did come to get her food. It woke her up from her slumber. But yeah, I'm excited for those games. Ragnarok 2, Horizon Dawn. I need to play Horizon Dawn 1. I'm catching up on the last few years of gaming, so I just started the Last of Us Remastered.
Okay.
I never got to play that, so I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of the controls.
That's a game I played, and I was like, well, that was a game. Like that to me was a bit overhyped, in my opinion.
Maybe it'll like get better, but I'm not a huge fan of like survival games.
I feel a lot of like sneaking around and like having to conserve like your ammo and find shit.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that kind of stuff. I just want to play the game. I don't have to worry about, you know, do I have enough bullets to do this level.
I think you would like Horizon then, because you do have to collect resources, but there's an abundance of them, so it's not like you can't use this amount of arrows or else you'll fucking die.
Ugh.
Like I think you'd like that one.
It's okay. Fun. And I don't know, I'm not that big into zombies either. I used to be, back when Left 4 Dead first hit.
That game was great. I loved Left 4 Dead.
I don't know if Back 4 Blood would be any good.
I don't know either.
It's made by the same team.
I got my dad, well, I didn't get my dad, but one of my brothers got my dad Left 4 Dead 2, because he's a big like zombie guy.
Okay.
And like he'll watch and play anything with zombies. And so he really liked the first Left 4 Dead.
I'm just tired of zombies culturally. So overstuffed. When this game first came out, it maybe wasn't. I think it was maybe when like
The Walking Dead was like still like brand new.
Yeah.
I'm always of the opinion, like, if you can put something new on it and make it interesting, then like then it'll work. You know what I'm saying? I know this was like a few years ago now, but like Train to Busan, like I feel like that's a good zombie movie that is different and unique, and I know Peninsula didn't do as well critically, the sequel to that, but I don't know, I feel like if you have a good idea and you can execute it, you can make anything good.
Yeah.
Regardless of how overplayed it is or what have you.
That's true.
It's all about ideas and execution.
Yes. And I think that's where God of War was so good for me. I love the idea and the execution.
Facts.
I think what I was saying is Cody Barlog, the director of that. we got off on this tangent. He has this great vision for Kratos, you know, being a dad again. Which if you know the story for God of War, then you'll have some insight into that. And I don't know, it was really good. It was really good.
Super good.
I can't wait for the second. That's it. That's all I got. I'm out of steam.
Me too.
Which means it's time to end this episode. Which means thank you guys so much for coming and listening to our two episodes on our favorite movies of the year. Next week, we are going to be talking with Josh Folsom coming back for his favorite of the year so we can round out this three-part series. I don't know what it is yet.
Okay.
Waiting to hear back from him. And we will promptly let you know on the Twitters.
The Twitters. The Twitter twatter.
Yes. The Twitterverse. And yeah, so at this point, I want to thank you guys for coming along. I do want to please ask you to go on to iTunes and Spotify and whatever you listen to us on and give us a 5-star review and rating. And it helps people, you know, find the show and helps us know that we're doing something good. Something right, something good. I don't know. Like I said, I'm out of steam. But yeah, it means a lot if you guys would do that. And you can always also subscribe to the Bonus Film Guys on Apple Podcasts, where you can get early episodes and monthly drunk commentaries, which we're hopefully going to get back to doing pretty soon here. But you do get these episodes early as soon as I get them edited, which is usually the day we record them.
Fuck yeah.
All right. If you guys have any comments, questions, or concerns, you can reach us on social media at Other Film Guys or me personally at Livin' Mediocre.
And I'm at Rocketman3. Just replace that O with a zero.
Thank you guys again for coming along, and we will see you next week.
Peace be with y'all.
Peace.